Hi, welcome to the Left Brain Artist. I'm Suzanne Redman. I've been doing these artist interviews every week now for about 3 months. Some of the artists I've met before and some are ones I've admired from afar. They're always interesting and their stories are so different. Today's no exception. I'll be talking in depth with artist and businesswoman Trina Slade Burks. Trina and her husband Anthony have created a business that supports artists by offering a few art exhibits per year. They also offer educational opportunities through their teaching, lectures, and mentoring. I've worked with Trina on some of her large pop-up galleries, and she'll explain the process, including why she first created art exhibits in her home, why she prefers exhibit spaces that are not the traditional white-walled room, why she offers entertainment, lectures, and other art disciplines at her events, and how she creates proposals and sponsorship requests. This is a great business episode for the artist that wants to create their own opportunities to get their artwork seen and sold. In my previous episode, number 27, I interviewed Trina's husband, Anthony Burks, and he talked about the first exhibits they held at their home. Be sure and listen to that episode, too, for more insights about Trina and Anthony's business. But before I start my interview with Trina, I'd like to define a term we use repeatedly in this episode to make sure you're clear on what we're talking about. We'll be talking about pop-up galleries. A pop-up is a business that just pops up for a short period of time at a location. Sometimes people will open pop-up shops around the holidays to take advantage of the many shoppers at that time of year. Often pop-up shops use storefronts that are currently empty and without a tenant. The building owner likes to offer the space to someone because having a pop-up shop shows potential tenants the possibilities of using that space. When someone creates a pop-up shop, like Trina and Anthony do, they are starting with a completely empty space and they bring in everything they need for the 2 to 3 week show. It's a lot of work, but they've been successful at creating these alternative gallery spaces for years. So here we go. This is Trina Slade Burks. Hi, Trina. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Suzanne. How are you?
I'm great. This is really nice. I've been looking forward to interviewing you.
Awesome.
Yeah. Trina and I have known each other for a long time. She is a force to be reckoned with in the art world of Palm Beach County, Florida, and I kind of volunteered my way into working with her and her husband on their art business and their pop-up galleries. So that's
absolutely
been fun. Yeah. But I wanted to start out with the beginnings of your art life. So tell me about where you grew up and when did you start making art? How did this all come to you?
I grew up in the Bronx, New York, and my mother was an artist, actually, and I used to watch her paint all the time. And she passed away when I was very young. I was 9. And what I started doing was fiddling around in her stuff after she passed away. I started looking through all her art books and her sketchbooks, and what I started doing was copying what she was doing.
Oh, okay.
And she worked a lot in color pencil, ironically, and I started just copying what I saw. She did a sketch of my bedroom, and what I did was I picked out all the colors of the color pencils that were in that sketch, and I tried to emulate it. And I guess that was kind of my start in really dabbling in art. I wouldn't say seriously, but I took an interest, and she did a lot of abstract paintings that were around the house. And then my father had a nude that she did of herself in his bedroom right over his bed.
Ah.
And at the time, I didn't know. And then I finally asked him about it. He's like, yeah, she was taking classes in figure drawing. And they took pictures of them as the model, and she drew it. So that was when I was like, oh, wow. you know.
Yeah.
This is really inspiring, actually. And I was probably, by the time I found that out, I was like about 12.
Okay. Well, you know, it's so interesting. I talked to different artists about their parents, whether they're artistic and whether they've encouraged them. And it was like your mother's inspiration and encouragement continued many years after you lost her. I think that's a wonderful story.
Absolutely. My father was not actually, my father's family, they're all academics. My mom's family is where the artistic skill comes from. So yes, she did inspire a lot of what I did. She really did.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Did you continue with art in high school, start to take some classes or just locally?
Actually, I did. What it was, I went to a college prep school in the Bronx called Cardinal Spellman. And I took art because I just had to. It didn't matter what my other classes were going to be. I was going to take art. So I did.
Okay.
And my father wanted me to be an accountant, so I was taking math classes. And I kind of bombed in the math area when I got to, like, junior year.
Okay, I don't believe that, because you're so left brain, right brain, even with the math.
I am, but in geometry, I wasn't very good.
Okay.
I found out years later that my math teacher wasn't very good either, and that's probably why I didn't do so well.
Oh, yeah, right.
But, yeah. But what I had to do is decide what was going to be my major to graduate. So I ended up double majoring in art and got my diploma in art, my Regents diploma in art. Before, now I don't think you can do that, but in New York State, you used to be able to do that.
That's so really cool.
It took me to really think about, what am I going to do when I get out of high school? To really consider, okay, should I go to art school? Should I go to another academic school? And I chose to go to the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale after I graduated high school.
So how did you even hear about that way down in Florida?
Well, it was me looking around, you know, back before there was internet.
Right.
I was trying to find a school in Florida, actually. I wanted to get out of New York. And we have a lot of art schools in New York City, you know.
Right.
I thought about going to Pratt. I thought about going to FIT. But I was, like, really tired of the city. So I just looked around. I knew about the Art Institutes as a company. So I said, there's got to be one in Florida. So I looked it up, and there was one in Fort Lauderdale. And I took the money my father gave me to apply for all those colleges. I don't know what I did with the rest of the money, but I know the only application I went and applied with was the Art Institute.
You were determined to get to Florida.
Yes, I was.
And I'm sure Fort Lauderdale sounded so cool and exotic, too.
Exactly. So I took a risk, and the way I actually got my father to bend was, another friend of mine told me, Trina, you know, you're really smart. You should go ahead and apply for the police academy here in New York City. So I told my dad I wanted to be a cop, and he's like, you know what? That school down in Florida sounds like an interesting idea. Let's go check it out, because he did not want me to be a police officer.
Ah, that was clever.
So that's how it all started.
Oh, my gosh. So you came down to Florida at what age?
18.
Oh, so that's pretty young going so far away. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. But I never really thought about it. You know, my son's kind of like me, too. He wants to kind of explore life. I didn't really say, oh, my goodness, I'm going away from home. I was an only child, so me going and doing something different by myself wasn't unusual.
Okay.
You know, I was pretty independent, so.
Yeah. Okay. So you came down to Florida, and were there other classmates from your high school that went to the Art Institute as well, or did you not know anyone?
I didn't know a soul.
Oh, my gosh.
I was the only person. I didn't know anybody in Fort Lauderdale. Had a few friends that went to North Florida, but not Fort Lauderdale. I was the only one.
Oh, wow.
So I went in there blind. I mean, we came to visit, and I met some of the people in the dorm that I was going to get to know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty much it. I didn't really get to make friends until I got there.
Okay.
And I have a lot of friends still now to this day that we stay in contact with.
Yeah, that's great. And I know just what was it, a month ago? We were walking around and you ran into one of your professors. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah. Mimi, she was, and actually she's a really good inspiration for Craig McGinnis too. He went to the Art Institute, ironically enough.
So, and you met him many years later though.
Yeah. Cause he's like 5 years younger than I am. So I wouldn't have met him anyway.
Yeah.
But, so she inspired me to understand how to mix paint, color theory, that kind of stuff. And I also respected her because she was like the first person I knew that had her own studio, her own working studio outside of her teaching.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So she took us on a trip there and I was just like floored with the space that she had and the work she produced. Yeah. So she was really, really inspiring.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And, I think I just read in the paper, what's the PS to the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale?
As of right now, from what we hear, they're going to be closing. They're closing a lot of the, there's so many of the schools that they had around the country that are closing down. And just a side note, it's not the same as the Art Institute of Chicago. It's not even affiliated.
So okay.
A lot of people get that confused, but they are not affiliated with that institution.
Okay. Yeah, but that's unfortunate because the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale was just a great place for local people to go if they couldn't get far away to get into an art school. Yeah.
It's true. I mean, and it's come a long way. When I was going, I don't even think it had they didn't even have a bachelor's program when I was there. Which was fine because I needed to start, you know, going and taking life a little bit more seriously anyway.
Okay.
But since then, they've improved in their programming. They had extended their academics. So it's kind of a bummer that they're going to be going.
Yeah.
Actually.
How long was the program that you were in?
I was only in a 2-year associate's program.
Okay.
For graphic, pretty much visual communications. So graphic design, photography. Like I learned a little bit about everything in the arts.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Yeah. And that's actually why I picked it. I could have went for fashion design and I kind of wanted to get the feel of what photography felt like, what going into the studio and developing your own film and learning about advertising. And so I wanted to get a feel of everything in the field. That's why I took that course.
All right. Did you take any fashion courses at all? Because your art has a fashion flair to it.
I did take a course in high school, but nothing in college.
Okay.
Nothing in college. And, you know, just had a little bit of an understanding of anatomy. My mother had those books that lied around the house, and I went through those. And she was also a seamstress, so she made her own clothes. So a lot of the things that she did, and I would look through all her sketches and stuff. So, again, she inspired a lot of that.
Okay, that's nice. So where did your art go? What did you do when you graduated?
Well, I came back home, and I was going to I wanted to go to Pratt, but I got hired as an art teacher from my old art teacher. She was actually the principal of a new school, and she asked me if I wanted to teach art, so I did. In the meantime, I went to an event called Black Expo, which was a place where you could find jobs in the field amongst Black professionals.
Okay.
And there was this group of guys, it was three of them, who were really cute, so I went to their booth, and it turned out they were graphic designers who worked with a lot of like hip hop artists and music businesses, and they designed logos for them. So I went to this thing and I sat with them and I brought my really amateur's portfolio for a portfolio review. But I appreciate they were very honest with me. And one of the partners took me under his wing and I learned a lot about the business side of how to run a business and managing money. And also about the graphic design part, but I appreciated the other side, hence back and forth with the brain.
Right, yeah.
Left brain, right brain.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
He was a fabulous designer. He works for Nike now. He started the team that does Jordan sneakers. So he was always a fantastic designer, but he was very, very smart in business. And I fully respect him to this day. So I was there until I got engaged and got married and moved back to Florida.
Okay. And so tell me about your husband real quick, because you met him in Florida, right?
I met him at the Art Institute.
That's what I thought.
Second year.
Okay.
Yeah, he and I are like totally different people. I met him through a friend. He was actually dating a friend of mine. That's how I actually met him.
Ah, the truth comes out.
Yeah. But they didn't last. And he actually came to me. He was like, you know, I want to take you out to dinner. And I always respected him as an artist. I used to like kind of low-key stalk his work.
Okay.
And I used to go to his house and watch him work. He was a really, really serious student, unlike me. He was really a I was a party animal until I got together with him.
Okay. So, yeah. All right.
But yes, we did meet at the Art Institute, and he, like you can tell now, his work is like ridiculous. It's so cool.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It is just so amazing. So I guess you did kind of a long distance relationship type thing, because ultimately you moved back down to Florida to be with him and get married. What did you do when you got down to Florida? Did you do some more graphic design?
Not so much graphic design. It was ironic. A company moved down from New York. I had a pen pal for years since I was a kid, and she worked for this company called Brooklyn Bow and Ribbon. And she's like, oh, they're going to be moving down to South Florida somewhere. I don't know where. It turned out across the street from where I lived is where they moved to. And I needed a job. The money I was getting from my teaching job was going to be running out in September. So I was looking around, and I went there and interviewed, and I started working in their factory producing bows for hats.
Okay.
They were like the first company. They were like an 82-year-old company, and they were the first company to produce hat bows for men's hats. So I was doing that, and then I got pregnant. So I spoke to my manager and I said, look, I can't stand on the factory floor while I'm pregnant. I need to do something.
Right.
He goes, well, you know, I was looking at your resume and I saw you had a background in design. He goes, they're going to be putting in a design department in the sample room. Maybe I can get you to move into there. So I started out as kind of an assistant to the people who made samples for companies that were produced long term. So for instance, they would make samples for, let's say, Buster Brown.
Okay.
And then send them over to Haiti, and they would produce, you know, the large scale amounts of bows for the company. So I was doing that, and then I started pretty much producing their designs for our sales team. And then from there I started producing their display packages for their trade shows.
Okay.
So I went from pulling ribbon for sample girls to assistant to head lead of the design team.
That's great.
Yeah. So, and I actually am still really good friends with the former owner.
Ah, okay.
To this day as well.
Does that company still exist down here?
They sold the company, I want to say 2 years after I left. I left in 2004, and they sold the company to their British affiliate. And by that time it was like an 89-year-old company or something that they sold. It started with the two brothers, and then their sons took it over, and then their grandsons took it over, and the grandsons sold it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so they're not here anymore.
Okay.
But ironically, I left that company and went to work for Macy's in their design department. And the reason I got the job was because I knew how to produce the bows that the company I formerly worked for short shipped them. So I produced like 300 and something large scale bows for their displays for Christmas.
Oh,
and that's
wow.
How I started working at Macy's. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. So you were working at Macy's, and during that time, were you also still teaching art or making art for you to sell?
I was not working for a full time company. I did work for a couple of nonprofits, Children's Coalition being one, where we went out into the at-risk communities and taught art to kids who were either in prison or just in bad neighborhoods, just trying to get them expressed with art.
Okay.
I was not doing work for myself or even to sell. I used to do that when I was in New York temporarily, like if somebody wanted me to do like a portrait of their grandchild. But I kind of got away from it for a while. I wasn't really producing art for art's sake. And then Anthony started getting me, you know, you got to start making some stuff just to do it, not necessarily to sell, but just to do it. So probably around the time I went and started working for Macy's, I started making like small paintings and sketches, nothing big.
Okay.
Not with the anticipation of selling anyway.
Okay. And, I know that you and Anthony started your company, ATB Fine Artists, but I don't know what the timing was for that and what came first. Did the two of you start doing like pop-up shows in your home before you put out the name ATB Fine Artists, or was it reverse?
It was reverse. We started out, in 92, the year after we got married. The goal was to sell Anthony's art and also to let people know that he was a graphic designer.
Okay.
So he worked for a sign company, but on the side, he was producing logos.
Okay.
And the internet just started getting, you know, on its feet, not quite what it is now,
mm-hmm.
probably about 94. And I started pretty much promoting his work via email.
Okay.
To different people, like emailing companies and galleries and museums his work, not knowing that was spam, but I just, it didn't matter.
Well, I mean, back then, email was, what else could you do but email?
Exactly.
Right.
So that's what I was doing. And basically, we were a graphic design company. We were actually called ATB Burke's Graphic Designers is what it originally was called.
Okay.
We had transitioned the name a few times since then to what it is now.
Okay.
But no, we were not doing shows. We didn't start really exhibiting the way we do now. We ran a company. We ran like a little gallery in Northwood, and that was in, I want to say, 2006 or so, 2007-ish,
mm-hmm.
around there, where we were running a gallery for EG Square,
okay.
which is a group that does exhibitions for students that go to Bach and Dreyfus and other Palm Beach County schools. So we were running that in Northwood for them, and we started, and then they let us take it over, is what happened.
Okay, all right.
And
when you took it over, were you doing calls to artists and inviting other artists to apply and display there?
We were, but we didn't know a lot of artists. So I think I got to go backwards a little bit.
Okay.
So I worked for Macy's until about 07.
Okay.
And I left there, and I might be getting the dates wrong, and I started working for Center for Creative Education.
Okay.
When I did that, at the same time, I was approached to apply for this group called Artists of Palm Beach County. It wasn't called that yet, but it was a call to artists to get together and talk about like-minded stuff. So it kind of all happened around the same time. So we're talking about between 04 and 07, where we were meeting artists. Because before then, we didn't really know a lot of artists in the community, believe it or not.
Right.
So those two ventures allowed us to kind of connect with artists in the community.
Okay. And I know Artists of Palm Beach County, they were created for the purpose of uniting artists throughout Palm Beach County, which is a really,
Absolutely.
Really large geographic area. Palm Beach County is huge. And so
it
they
is.
Were trying to unite everybody under one umbrella. Were you at the ground floor at the planning stages of this whole group?
Yes, I wasn't part of the initial three, which was Mark Garrick, Terry Rybovich, and Karen Hackman. They were the originators.
Okay.
And they did the call around the county. So they did a bunch of meetups in different locations like the Armory Arts Center and a couple of other areas within the geographic area of Palm Beach County. So I met when they were at the Armory.
Okay.
And I was the only African American person there, female, and my husband was the only African American male in that group of people. So they kind of wanted to reach different diverse areas.
Okay.
So they asked questions like, would you be interested in being, you know, a board member, or would you be interested in being a chair of something? And I volunteered and I said, yeah, absolutely. So I was literally part of the steering committee.
Okay.
That branched into our board.
Okay.
So yeah, and I was with them for 7 years. That's how I got to meet artists in the community. That right there was a game changer.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just to say me too, because I was so involved with the Wellington Art Society, which is based in Wellington, Florida, mm-hmm. which is west of West Palm Beach. But I wanted to meet artists from all over, so that's why I joined Artists of Palm Beach County. And I met people from all over and started going to their events. And it's a great umbrella organization to meet a lot of people.
So that is exactly what helped us connect. So literally I started gathering names of artists, trying to find out what they did in the community, what part of Palm Beach County were they in. And, you know, the initiative that Anthony and I had started initially, believe it or not, started out with trying to get Black artists seen. And we didn't realize that the entire county felt that they were not being seen as artists. So not that our initiative changed, because we still do a lot of stuff with African American artists, but the programming of what we wanted to do shifted from not just Black artists, but artists throughout the county.
Okay.
And so we started doing shows in our home. We moved here in 06 and we did our first pop-up in our house in 07. Even though we were managing that gallery over there in Northwood, we didn't really take the management part to where we were in the space until probably after our fourth show or third show here at our house.
Okay.
EG Squared asked us if we would start bringing in artists and like kind of managing on a, you know, full-time basis. And that's when we started doing calls and inviting artists. And a lot of artists already knew us, and just, we were like, okay, we want to do this look, so maybe we should ask this group of artists. We wanted to do, let's say, a celebration of women, so we knew women artists. Let's get them involved, you know. So it just kind of naturally worked its way into how we wanted to maneuver our shows.
Okay. And so now you and Anthony and your organization, your business, has become known for uniting artists and providing opportunities for them in Palm Beach County. And so
right.
It started really small, just doing pop-ups in your house. So when you did the pop-ups in your house, did you invite other artists as well, or it was just your art and Anthony's art?
It was a variety of artists. Actually started with one particular person who lived in our community named Leah Jefferson. She's since passed. She was a jewelry designer, and she connected us a lot with the African American community. But she talked a lot about when she was in DC, how they used to take over these big houses and host these big art exhibitions. So, and I can't remember the name of her event, but she wanted to do something a little bit different from that. So it was her, myself, Anthony, Barbara Cheeves, mm-hmm. and then we would invite different artists. So
okay.
Literally by word of mouth, we had people calling us to be involved in this show. Like, we started out with, I think it was like 7 artists. So we would rotate it like every quarter. We would do, you know, like the same 4, and then we would invite like 4 more.
Okay.
You know, and, mm-hmm. and we were also involved with Fox School of the Arts, because we used to adjudicate for their auditions for visual, so we invited a lot of times their art teachers who are artists to be involved as well, because they had a different demographic of people that
okay.
we wanted to introduce to the community, pretty
okay.
much the Northwood community.
Yeah.
So it was fun. It was a good, nice start to something that's grown into something that I can't even believe, actually, how big it's
yeah.
gotten.
Yeah.
You
and
know?
I didn't realize that your connection with the biggest art schools in Palm Beach County went back so many years. Bach is the middle school of the arts, and
yes.
Dreyfus is the high school of the arts.
Yes.
So I didn't realize you'd been involved with them for so long, because
yeah.
now you do portfolio prep, right? For when
yes.
people, the kids have to actually audition with a portfolio in order to get into the schools?
The way it started was, like I said, we adjudicated for both Dreyfus and Bach. And we were noticing, actually, one of the coordinators at the school was saying that there's a certain demographic that's not being reached. You know, they had a lot of affluent kids that were getting the opportunity to audition, but a lot of the kids in the at-risk communities were not getting what they needed. So fast forward to probably 2010, they'd stopped the, like, we were outside teachers. We did not teach at the school.
Right.
And they provided us the opportunity to adjudicate. So about 2010, the school district stopped outside influence. So what we decided to do was be that opportunity for people who did not have the means to be able to pay for a teacher. So we started out on a volunteer basis, helping kids who needed just to know what they needed to know for these auditions.
Right, what they to expect.
Right. They stopped the portfolio process, and it's basically on-hand audition only now. So what started happening, a lot of locations were requesting Anthony first. He got this reputation for being able to be a great influencer for these kids to understand what they needed to do. And then they found out that I had a teaching background, so people started reaching out to me. So now we teach at a few different locations, not just at-risk communities, but also I teach up in Palm Beach Gardens. Anthony teaches at the Armory Arts Center. We both teach at Easel Art. So we're pretty much around the county at different locations. And then we do private teaching as well. Just teaching the fundamentals of understanding the process.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me go back to the pop-up shows that you did in your home. So I guess at some point, did you realize we need to have it in a bigger place? Or how did it happen that you left your home? What was the first big event that occurred outside of your home?
Well, EG Squared had the space that's now Relish. It's Relish now. But at the time,
The restaurant space?
Yes.
Right in Northwood. Okay.
So they had a space that was literally, I think it was like four big rooms. Well, four rooms and then one huge room.
Okay.
And the first time, our first event we did, I think the largest amount of artists we had was somewhere between 18 and 20 artists.
Yeah, that's a good size.
Yeah, and we just cherry picked. We knew what artists did what, and we had enough artists that we were connected with that we just said, look, we're going to do this show. Do you want to be a part of it?
Okay, great.
At that time, 18 was a lot of artists for me. I taught kids, not adults. So just getting them to get their stuff there on time. And there wasn't a real organized format for it. It was just them, you know, delivering their stuff and hanging their stuff. And it was always a collective and collaborative effort. So that was the first big show we did. And I remember there was friends of mine that I knew from up north who called the day before the event. They had heard about it on social media, and they were congratulating me because they knew I was involved in the arts on a different level.
Okay.
And it was really cool to see that people outside of the community I lived in were actually taking it as seriously as the people in the community.
That's nice.
So that was really cool.
That's encouraging. It was.
So we did, the brand is called Collaboration. And the vision was for us to be in alternative spaces, not necessarily a gallery, because a lot of cases artists came to us because galleries were not accepting them.
Okay.
So we didn't initially want to call it a gallery because it kind of left a bad taste in a lot of artists' mouths of their experiences with gallery affiliations. So
okay.
That's why we started in the home and started in these little pop-up areas. So even though EG Square was technically a gallery, we didn't view it as one because it was more about instructing them on how to get to the next level versus making them follow all these really crazy rules that they didn't want to follow. So it was allowing them to be artists, but being a little bit more professional about the way they presented the work so they can get to that level.
Yeah. So from the start, you and Anthony and your business were really teaching and training these adult artists on how to be professional and how to present their work for a show and what to do once you're in the show. But it came from your work with the kids, with the children,
yeah.
Getting them prepared
yeah.
to to apply to the art schools. I'd never quite seen that connection until you explained it to me just now. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you weren't doing formal calls to artists yet because you were tapping into your network of artists that you knew.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And periodically we would, like, if there was an emerging artist that was referred to us, we would bring them in and they would be like a guest. You know, just so they could see the ropes of what the professionals were doing, you know, so they wouldn't necessarily get the prime spots in the space, but they would have to be there to learn the take to hang the work. You know, how does the work supposed to look when it comes into the space?
Yeah.
You know, we were tough on them. We were like, no, that, you know, that has cracks in it. No, that's not professionally, you know, hung or whatever it was.
We just
taught them all those things. So we were, you know, really good about bringing in emerging artists, but hence we gave a lot of great opportunities for artists who either had just gotten back in the game because they had been working a regular 9-to-5 for like 30, 40 years. They retired and wanted to get back into the scene, or the ones who were like mid-career, but they didn't really know where to take their course. So did they need to learn some new stuff, or did they just want to, you know, see what their professional life could be. So, you know, we worked with all different kinds of artists.
Okay. Yeah. And,
you know,
right. And what you're talking about right now is what you did at the beginning with collaboration and these events. But my experience with you is you're still doing it today. You're still helping the emerging artists and the students. So for example, at your pop-up gallery just this past January, Continuum, you always have a student portion, and this was
right.
A pretty large student portion this year.
It was.
What did you have, about 25, 30 pieces of art? And you had a separate section in the gallery just for them.
Yep. They're called Young Masters. So I'm going to go back a little. Anthony and I had did a student show with some Dreyfus kids and a couple of middle school kids called Young Masters of Collaboration.
Okay.
Is what it was called. And from there, the kids would come in on different days where we're in the gallery and just learn about the processes of the professional side of things.
Okay.
Not the student side. They learned that at Dreyfus or whatever school they were at. So we kind of did the same thing with this. We called them the Young Masters of Continuum, and it was to teach them that they're not students anymore once they join this program, that they're trying to build their professional side, so learning all the processes, just like with the adults, about how to hang work, how to present work, how to build your portfolio, how to do your resume, all those important things that an adult needs to know. We were helping them with this process.
Okay.
So they would come in there and do their volunteer hours, meet the artists, have conversations, learn about the field that they're in, whether they're a photographer or a sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
They would meet with some of the professionals in the show just to kind of get some inspiration and, you know, knowledge. So that's what it grew into, this process that you saw in January. And it was, you know, it was serious. They had awards and they got to sell their work.
Yeah.
They got, you know, certificates for, you know, professionalism. And then they had mentors. Their mentors were their peers in the school. It wasn't us. It was their own peers. So ages 16, 17, and 18 year old peers who had went through the process the year prior.
Oh, okay.
And they still were required to follow the same guidelines and be part of it as well.
Okay. Yeah. And when you say, you know, they helped and they did volunteer hours and they helped hang, I know I was helping hanging the show and I had some students working with me. And, you know, what you see is if you have a dozen students who have submitted work and have work hanging there, there's always going to be four who are going to work their tails off, and they're, you know, four or six, and they're going to work so hard. And, you know, it's all about however much time they put into it, they're going to get that back.
Out of it.
Yeah, they're going to get it back. And those were the ones who learned the most, the ones who were hanging out at the gallery, who were always there. You know, they're just, oh, so-and-so's back. Let's put her to work. And they learn the most. So it's great that you give them that opportunity, and then but they do have to take it and run with it a little farther if they want to learn more. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
So let me go back to collaboration. So you did quite a few collaboration pop-up type shows, and they started out with in the EG Squared space. What were some of the other spaces that you've used over the years?
Basically, there was two EG Square spaces. So we had another show that was coming up, and unfortunately, the person who owned the other space wanted EG Square to leave. So literally in the middle of us planning our show, we already had the cards printed up. But what was funny, right across the street, forgive me for the address. I think one address was 203 and the address we moved to was 208.
Okay.
So what we did was we moved into 208 and then we had to take Sharpies and change all the addresses from 3 to 8. So we had two different spaces for EG Squared at that time. So collaboration, I think at that time we had three here. Two across the street. We had a good 7 shows.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Before we started branching into the collaboration African diaspora and collaboration Boys to Men. Then we moved, Boys to Men was the first show we did outside of that venue. That was on Dixie, the first one.
Okay.
And literally, Paul Fisher had asked us to host a pop-up. He didn't know how it was, you know, what we were going to do. He just needed us to do something. I came up with this plan because at the time, I had noticed there was a lot of male artists, like in the 40-somethings, that were getting a lot of recognition and a lot of women getting recognition. But the people under the age of 30 and the guys under the age, over the age of 50, we're not getting recognition.
Okay.
So I wanted to put together a show where they can all influence each other. So from, I think it was from 16 to 85.
Oh, wow.
Years of age. And we had a variety of different guys. I think there was literally only like 10 of them.
Okay.
But it was a vast, you know, difference in their work. We had sculptors, painters, photographers, mixed media artists, and they were all in this space. And it was really inspiring because it was so different. And they weren't all from Palm Beach County. They were from South Florida. But I had like one from Brevard County, and then I had one that came up from Miami.
Okay.
So it was really cool because it was something we put together really fast, but it was done really well. And that was like the first time we took collaboration out of the, you know, the corridor of Northwood Road.
Okay.
And started bringing it on the street. And then after that, we partnered with 4 other galleries for another show on Dixie. So JF Gallery, Ursula Fernandez had a gallery. And then I forget the other two. Betty
Wilson.
Yeah, Betty Wilson had her gallery, and then there was another gallery, and I can't remember what it was, but it was like 4, it was kind of like an art walk on Dixie.
Okay.
They did have to drive to the locations because they were kind of spread out, but there were artists in each space that collaborated with another artist from each space. So they had work. So it was a real cool way for people. It was on Easter weekend, and people who wanted to stay in town came to those 4 spaces, and they knew that they were going to see great art.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Yeah, and it also forced art businesses to work together as well, which was part of what our mission was too, for them to not be so exclusive, but more inclusive with each other.
Okay.
You know.
So how many years ago was this?
That was in 2009.
Okay. So back in 2009, how were you advertising shows? This was before we were maniacs with Facebook and everything.
Yeah, I was just on Facebook, but the way I literally mailing. We mailed our invitations. So those invitations, I told you that we had to change the number.
Oh, wow.
We made flyers and we mailed them.
Okay.
And all of us, and part of the rule with the artist was that, you know, you're part of this collective. You have to email to your clients just like we're emailing to our clients.
Okay.
And in this case, with galleries being involved, they connected to their mailing list as well. So we provided, we used to get like, we still do, like 5,000 cards, and everybody mailed them to their contacts.
Oh, that's great.
And literally, so that's how we were able to get large amounts of people to these events, because at that time, people were still opening their mail.
Right.
Oh, it's gosh. A little different now, but then it was easier.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Now we still get artist postcards made, but we leave them on a table for people to
exactly.
pick up. We don't actually mail them out anywhere.
But yeah, that's that. The number one way was through mailing.
Okay.
So yeah.
All right. All right. So that was pretty neat. So that was a big undertaking of coordinating four different galleries, and the galleries were in existence. When did you start going to spaces that were empty for pop-ups, just like an empty storefront that hadn't been leased out for a while?
We started that probably 2014. Yeah. We approached the Downtown Development Authority because
of West Palm Beach.
Yeah. In West Palm Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Because we as artists were starting to tap into other things like Art Palm Beach and these well-known events that bring in other types of people from other parts of the world. And we wanted to kind of connect into that network.
Okay.
So we reached out to Rafael Clemente, and I actually had met Rafael through a mutual friend. We were already doing things with Rafael or with the spaces that they had downtown on a small scale for charity. So he already knew our name, and I said, well, let me see if I can get like a space that's empty. Somebody else referred him. And I sat with him and I said, look, you know, we have this idea, Art Palm Beach. And then there was another one, an international fine art fair was going on in the same time. And, you know, like right after in January.
And those were at the big convention center in downtown West Palm Beach. And then you're approaching him about using a empty storefront in downtown West
Right.
Palm Beach. Okay.
So since we're like not far from each other, it would
Yeah.
have been perfect trying to get people to come downtown. Once they're done looking at the art or buying the art there, they could come over to where we're at and maybe, you know, stop at a restaurant, eat, drink, and be merry, you know, that kind of thing. So, he was all about it, and they put money behind the project. So that's where we got our trusty artist to get involved, and we came up with the name, which was now Continuum.
Okay.
Which we voted on. It was a whole, you know, process. And the artists got involved. So we have people like Craig McGinnis and Tony Hernandez and Eduardo Mendiera.
Yep.
And you.
Yeah.
And ourselves. And we pretty much took over a space.
Okay.
You know, so, and it was amazing. We,
yeah.
The first one, we didn't do a real call, maybe like towards the end, because we needed to fill some spaces, because they gave us a really, really, really big space.
Yeah, I think maybe we were trying to find more sculptures, more 3D art near the end. Yeah.
And so we were like, okay, we need somebody, you know, we didn't charge or anything. We were just like, look, we need you guys who are sculptors, who want to be in the show, an opportunity to connect with international art buyers. And it worked.
Yeah.
We got people there. You
okay.
Know?
Yeah, it did. It did. So when you say we didn't charge, you weren't charging a submission fee to artists to submit and apply for the show, right? Okay.
Right. Not at
okay.
that time.
At the first year. Right. So the first year was, you could call it like a grassroots effort, because it was you reaching out to your contacts and calling people and saying, well, you know, I love your paintings. I'd really like you to have a couple here. Do you know anyone else who you can recommend? And it just kind of snowballed from there. But, and it was a huge success. It was what, a full week the first time?
Was it
2 weeks?
It was 3 weeks.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it was 3 weeks.
Yeah, it was three full weeks. Oh my gosh, it was. We lived and breathed at that place.
In that space.
Yeah, yeah.
It was 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I remember by the end, I had no voice. And I was still working, by the way, while I was doing that. So I would go and teach my classes, and
then
take the bus over, because Anthony's already at the space.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a busy 3 weeks. And then keep in mind, it was longer than 3 weeks because we had to set it up.
Right.
So it was like another week before. So we're talking really 4 weeks worth of our time in there.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And so you were mentioning the some of your other collaboration shows, maybe with 10 artists on the Boys to Men, and one of your big ones was 20 artists. But how many was the first Continuum? That was a lot of...
Yeah, it was 50.
Yeah, 50 artists. Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot to manage. And I know you've learned a lot, and you
yes,
I was
going
to say, you know, what's the one tip you can give people? But, you know, there's just so many, you know, it's like a whole class you could teach on how to do a pop-up art show.
Yes.
I think the biggest thing was that, so that was, it became about 50 artists, but the biggest thing was that next year you said, we're going to do it with a call to artists this time.
Yes.
And make it more formal. Right. So what would you say were the reasons why you switched to a formal call to artists?
We felt, you know, just an experience in even exhibiting work ourselves, and Anthony even mentioning this and Craig saying this, we felt that the investment from the artists would make more sense. I felt like as a free cherry-picked event, they kind of pulled work from under their beds and dusted them off. I don't want to say a total lack of seriousness. I felt that if we did a formal call, they would treat it with a lot more respect. And even, you know, our calls to art is a pretty affordable. We try to keep it, if they're investing in it, they're going to take it more seriously. So,
right.
And it was easier to manage in terms of how many people were in the show, how many people do we have to account for, you know, things like name badges and tags and
the title cards and, yeah.
You know, it's just to do it in a formal setting, it's easier to keep track of everything.
Okay. All
right.
So
on the business side.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you did your first call to artists, the event was you've done it, what, 5 years now? The Continuum pop-up show? Okay, so
Yes. Your
first year, and you do it every January, it's around the end of January. So your first year, it was all, I'm going to say flying by the seat of your pants, but you really weren't, because you guys are organized in what you're doing, but it was making a lot of phone calls, just calling people around saying, hey, do you want to be in the show? And having to explain it to them and where it will be and the whole concept. Because one of the issues with doing a pop-up show, especially when you're working with a downtown organization like you did with the Downtown Development Downtown Development Authority?
Yes.
Okay. Is they're looking at their empty storefronts downtown. And
Right. It's
a win-win for them, because if you can go in there and put in a show and show that you can get 200, 300, you know, 1,000 people over 3 weeks coming into this storefront, you're showing how it can be a successful storefront. That's good for potentials who want to look at it and possibly lease it.
Exactly.
But the downtown person is looking at a couple of empty spaces. So one of the issues was they didn't tell you exactly which one they were going to give you until the last minute. So that
Right. Hindered
your marketing in that you couldn't exactly give an address. And
Right. So
that is a problem. And yet you still got 1,000 people, you know, thousands of people came through there over 3 weeks. So I just wanted to put that out there, because it shouldn't deter people from doing a pop-up show.
You're absolutely right. Actually, what would end up happening, you know, where we were so used to doing our mailers so far in advance and mailing them out to our contacts, actually that process is what stopped us from doing a lot of mailings, because we didn't know where we were going to be literally until probably the month before.
Okay.
And by that time, a lot of people already have on their calendar what they're going to do. But somehow, through osmosis, I guess, or people just knowing what we've done over the years, they're like,
oh, yeah,
there's that Continuum event going on. Let's go and check it out, you know. And then the PR of the Downtown Development Authority and their connections and our connections has, you know, we've developed relationships with things like the Cultural Council that we can get into their mailers, and they have relationships also, and with the newspaper and that kind of thing. So that helped a lot as well.
Okay.
So a lot of it had to do with PR and being very strategic, because, you know, you're right. It is a setback when you have to wait to know where you're going to be.
Right.
You know, it changes how you do your marketing strategy.
Right.
Because we don't have a permanent spot.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But then when the event is actually starting, you had, oh my gosh, all kinds of things. You had music. You had, I know one of your events, and I may be getting the years mixed up, but one of your events, you did have an admission fee at the door, and the amounts were going to a local charity that helped kids, Faith's Place. And those kids are taught by Faith's Place. They're taught music. And so the kids had a drum line and played drums in front of the space to kind of draw people in. And that was wonderful. Yeah, that was wonderful.
We did that for 3 years.
Yeah.
We did that. The first year we didn't charge. We pretty much paid them outright. The second and third year, what we did was we had people donate, new sneakers, because part of it was also, raising awareness, because these kids do this activity after school. They are a marching band, but they're affiliated with schools in the community that need shoes for back to school. So they were kind of the hub to doing that. So we felt like, okay, we can charge at the door or donate the sneakers. So it was good for the first 3 years. It worked out for them to their benefit. A lot more organizations and people knew who they were, so they get booked all over the county now and nationally.
Oh, that's great.
As well. So
yeah.
It was a benefit. It was the benefits always outweigh the little setbacks that we have, which is great.
Yeah, and you tied the theme of your opening night to that, where all of your guests, we were bringing a brand new pair of shoes to donate, but the theme was black tie and sneakers.
Sneakers,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So that was kind of fun for the ladies to get dressed up but be able to wear some sneakers. Instead of heels.
Exactly. Although some people rebelled, but that's okay. But
yeah.
Most of us, we took advantage highly of the
Absolutely.
Sneaker.
Yeah.
And they also got to bid on painted sneakers created by local artists. And part of the proceeds, we did a unique thing with that. Part of the proceeds went to the charity and part of the proceeds went back to the artist as well, which normally doesn't happen. A lot of times people forget about the artists and a lot of these fundraisers. So we want, they invested a little bit of money to be able to get the sneakers. So we wanted to give them back the money plus, by when the person bids on the sneakers, they're getting something also.
Right.
So it was a win-win.
That's a great way to do it, because so often artists are asked to donate a piece of art for a fundraiser and they're not getting anything in return, and it's exposure or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
But the artist has made a beautiful piece of art. And in this case, they were given a brand new pair of sneakers that was donated to you, and then they painted and decorated them, and they were amazing. In fact, I'll try to include some of those photos in the show notes so people can see the decorated sneakers.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. But let me go back to, the first year it was calling your friends and let's get together and do this pop-up. I'm really oversimplifying it because it was about 50 artists at a huge 3-week undertaking. The second year, right? Really oversimplifying.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So the second year you did the call to artists and it all went through your email or your business email. And I seem to recall it crashed your email. What happened?
Yeah. Well, because we were not using, formative programs like Cafe.
Yeah.
What ended up happening, like many artists do, they waited to the last minute. And the system crashed in the middle of probably the last 2 or 3 hours.
Right.
A bunch of artists were trying to submit at the last minute.
And you're realizing this late at night because you gave it a midnight deadline.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're finding out probably about, so if they're sending it, we even have people who were from Palm Beach County, but they're trying to send it from somewhere else. So their time is different from where we're at.
Okay.
And I'm finding this out maybe about 8:30 at night. And I'm like, oh God, you know, now if I had a, if it was a regular site like Cafe, Cafe usually will offer an opportunity to extend time, but I didn't really know if I should extend it or not. You know, we did have a lot of submissions, but right. I mean, I wanted to be fair. So I felt like me being over that, that I, gave a lot of leeway where probably as a professional, I shouldn't have, but okay. I did because it was the first time we did the call that way and we understood the technology and how it was. So we extended it a little bit. But when we did that, it was a learning experience as to why we do use the tools that are offered, like a cafe
right.
or some of those other services that are out there, because there's a little bit more control. And if it's a problem on their end, they can handle the bunch of problems that could happen.
Right.
Whereas we didn't anticipate it to be the way it was.
Okay. So,
you know.
So eventually you did switch over to Cafe, which is callforentry.org. And it's a service that anybody can use, a website where they can set up a call for artists and people send it to Cafe. And then you have a password, protected file
right.
and you get all these. So the way you've done it is you've said people can submit up to three pieces and are you telling them one photo per piece? So just three photos?
We used to do it where we allow for three pieces and because they don't offer a section where people can do like a detail. So we allowed it up to six pieces. So what was happening, people that were not sculptors were sending six pieces of art.
So six different paintings.
Yeah.
Right.
I've consistently spoken with Cafe about considering an option there where they could put a detail so it doesn't take away from them their submission opportunity.
Okay.
So I think they're working on that. I think it's very necessary.
Yeah.
Because what was happening, and we found out at the last call, which was our fifth anniversary, was people were sending in, you know, six images of six different pieces of work, and then my jurors were picking them. And we ended up with like 70 something artists because they're judging blind. They don't know who they're picking and they might think, oh, this is a nice piece of art. They're picking it for the art. They're not realizing that you're not picking the same artist either. You're picking like a totally different artist with a totally different style.
Right.
So what they might think is one artist turns out to be four artists. And
yeah,
Yeah,
that is difficult when you're making it blind. You don't want the jurors to see the names when they're judging
right.
who gets into the show and who doesn't. Yeah, okay.
I mean, and I think it's fair, I you know, because,
yeah.
you know, we pick
yeah.
a lot of people that know artists and they know their work. They've either exhibited their work or they've bought their work or whatever.
Right.
And we just want it to be fair. And it's worked for the most part, but it does make it a little bit sketchy on the end of, oh my goodness, how many artists are we going to have this year? And with not knowing the space size, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it's a gamble, but
yeah,
it's part of the fun.
Yeah. Oh, is that what you call it? Fun? Oh my gosh. Because, you know, I've helped out with the taking of the art. So, and I'll, let me explain that. So let's say, what is your deadline? October 31st, usually?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So for a end of the January show, they need to submit their photos by October 31st. And then let's say the show begins January 28th. Well, the take-in would be January
16th or something like that.
Something like that. A couple weeks before where the ones who have been accepted into the show need to deliver their artwork. And, so the taken comes in and all this art comes in. You've sent all the emails. You've said, congratulations. You're Blue Flowers have made it into the show. And they bring all this artwork and it starts stacking up against the walls of this empty gallery. And I look at that and I say, no way. You're never going to be able to fit all this on the wall. And Anthony, your husband, always takes charge of the arranging and the hanging, and boy, he manages to pull it off every year.
Every year. I mean, we've been into some small spaces and I'm like, it's not happening. You're going to have to put some stuff in the back, and somehow it all works.
Yeah, you've never had to call anyone back and say, oops, we said you were in the show, but you can't fit. Yeah, somehow you figured it out, which is amazing. But it's also good because you get a combination of the 2D and the 3D work. So you do have access to a lot of pedestals from different organizations that you just borrowed temporarily.
Actually, they would donate it.
Oh, now you own them. Okay.
Yeah, we actually own them.
That's right. A gallery went under and you took over.
Nice gallery. She said, you know, I need to be able to give these away. I'm not charging anything. And I knew like a bunch of different places. And she's like, no, I want to deliver it to one place. And I said, okay. So I called my contact. I said, do you have space for us to store these? And he's like, sure. So we have a few over at the armory too.
That's great.
Most of them are at this one location for storage, thanks to Tony Hernandez, the artist.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Okay. So, I want to go back to, talking about you said your first continuum pop-up gallery was 3 weeks and you've reduced it. They're about 2 weeks.
They're 2 weeks.
You know,
now.
Maybe covering 3 different weekends, but tell me about the other events that you have. It's not just a gallery that that's open and it has hours. You do a grand opening party. You do bands and you do fashion shows, all kinds of things to get people in to see this art over this small period of time. So,
right.
Yeah. Tell me, you know, what was your reason for bringing all these other things into it, like fashion shows and you've done body painting competitions. Why do all those extra things?
Well, one of the reasons that we decided to do it is because people tend to be a little bit overwhelmed when they hear a gallery opening. They think white walls and art on the wall and some person coming over with a clipboard trying to hassle them into buying art.
Okay.
But they don't realize that art influences so many different areas of life, period, and so many creative ways of connecting them. So, like, for fashion, like, again, my mother was a seamstress. I've always had an affinity for fashion. So showing artists and fashion designers collaborating on a concept visually just made sense. And people like fashion shows. They just like the whole glitz and glamour of it all.
Right.
And that invites all kinds of people. But you might have people that wouldn't want to come on the opening night because it's a big fundraiser and it's a lot of people and it's a little bit, claustrophobic. But they would come on a day where there's maybe a brunch and lecture where they can learn something about why is art so important to begin with.
Right.
Why is art in our community? So it's partially for learning, partially the connection of art and other things and how they connect. And we attract different types of people on different days. Not everybody's going to like the same thing. Someone who wants to come to a lecture may not want to come to the fashion show. Someone who wants to come to the artist talks may not want to come to the opening night. So it gives different people in our community a chance to see it in a different vision.
Okay.
That may connect with them, you know.
Yeah.
We don't expect, you know, we have some people that come every event. And then we have some that want to come when it's a little bit more low key and quiet. So it's, you know, to give them a choice.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned artist talks. Tell me about that. What is the artist talk?
Well, the artist, we call it Meet the Artist, and it's an opportunity for some of the artists to talk about their influences of the work that's in the show and their influences as an artist, period. It also gives artists the opportunity to connect with the crowd and connect with potential collectors, because in a gallery setting, that's not an option. They basically are there. I always jokingly say that there is the prop and their art is the feature.
Okay.
So, you know, they're not allowed to really say a whole lot to the clients. They could just say, hi, my name is so-and-so and this is my work. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
They don't, because the gallery's goal is to make money, and that's understandable. But in this case, this is teaching the artists how to connect with collectors so they can establish their own body of collectors on their own, where maybe they're not comfortable being in a gallery, or maybe they don't have access to being in a gallery, but they have access to people who want to collect their work.
Okay.
So sometimes people want to know what influences the artist. why did the artist paint that tree under the sun? And then there's a bird over there. Why? You know, they want to know. So this is giving the artist the opportunity to explain what's going on in their head and on the canvas.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, yeah. So, and then you mentioned the lunch and lecture, or brunch. You usually do a brunch one of the last weekend days of your pop-up gallery. But you've also done luncheon lectures, completely unconnected and outside of Continuum and your other galleries. And you just said that you're going to start that up again. So what have those been like?
Those have been, they're actually really informative. We started doing this for a couple of reasons, to get artists to come outside of their comfort zone and go to another location in their community, to learn about some of the businesses that support artists. So usually I pick a restaurant that is a supportive space, and we have somebody come in, or I'll teach it. Somebody that comes in and gives them information about building their brand or helping them establish themselves as a professional artist.
Okay.
We've hosted one at my lawyer's law firm because she does copyright law. And
great.
They learned what to do if they're in a situation with, you know, maybe a gallery or developing contracts, all those important things that artists kind of don't think about. But they should, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, and sometimes, believe it or not, sometimes they don't come unless they know I teach the class, because they want to hear from me directly. I don't know if it's as a peer. I don't really, one person's like, okay, when's the next time you're teaching? And I'm like, well, you know, I have somebody lined up for this. Okay, well, when you're teaching, let me know. So sometimes it's just a comfort zone, I guess.
Yeah.
But I always feel like people should learn, you know, kind of like you should learn from other people besides your mother or your father. You should hear an outside point of view, because maybe us telling you over and over again is not working, but you hear it from an outside source and maybe it resonates. So, and I think also because they should meet people who can help them.
Right.
Other than just me, because yeah. I can't write your contract. But an attorney can, you know what I mean? I can't.
Right.
There's certain things I can't do. I can explain it to you as to why, but I can't help you in that process. So sometimes you need to understand there are people out there that can help you with those areas that you're not comfortable with.
Okay.
So I always encourage people to, you know, even if I'm not the one teaching the class, somebody that I have them there for a reason, because they know their stuff. So, you know, trust me enough that I know that a Suzanne Redman knows what she's talking about, you know, or Eileen Adams knows what she's talking
right.
about. So
yeah.
It doesn't have
Thank
to
you.
Be me all the
mm-hmm.
time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. All right. I want to talk about one more thing with the big events that you do, because we're talking really big events when I'm saying you have 50 to 70 artists in these galleries for a couple of weeks and you've got thousands of people walking through the doors. You're very good at reaching out and getting sponsorships. Do you have any advice for people for when they want to do events and want to get sponsorships?
What I would suggest, know what you want, know your network as to who you're trying to reach, because that's the first thing they're going to ask you. Who is your network? Who are you connected to? Like, I got Bombay Sapphire at a whim. I was trying to get a local vodka company, and mm-hmm. they couldn't accommodate 500 people because they're, you know, a small business. So I was watching something on TV, which they're connected to another big event down in Miami. And I turned to Anthony and I said, should I call Bombay and see if they would do it? So I called them and they said, send me a proposal. And the proposal, basically, they want to know who is your reach, what is the age bracket, what is their professional level, all those important things that they want to tackle, because they're a gin company. They have a market they're trying to reach.
Right.
So know what you want. And don't be afraid to ask. Don't be afraid to ask. A lot of times people think, well, I'm a small little business and they're a big corporation. Just ask. The worst they can say is what? No.
Right.
And
right.
Then you go on to the next business.
Yeah. And I think a business like that, they do these things all the time. So it's not like you're coming from left field approaching them
right.
about a sponsorship. And you ended
exactly.
up, yeah, you ended up getting sponsorship from them for multiple years, right?
Yeah, we got them first for our African diaspora for two different times.
Okay.
And for Continuum twice, and then they sponsored product another time. All their bars were tapped out, but they had enough that they can send us product as well. So, you know, they're a really good company to connect, and their mission has a lot to do with the arts anyway. But that goes to saying, make sure that the people you're trying to reach out to has the same vision as you. Don't reach out to a company that has no interest in the arts, because it doesn't make a good partnership.
Right.
And try to include some of your local businesses who are willing to extend something. Like, we reached out to a bakery downtown, and I asked them, I said, you know, we've used them. We hired them for a couple of events, and I said, would you be interested in sponsoring something small? I said, you know, it doesn't have to be anything major. It could be just like little cupcakes or little cookies. They
right.
ended up sponsoring 50 rum cakes.
Oh, that's great. And
that's Ganache downtown on Dixie, I believe.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They were like, sure, you know, I'm expecting like cute little cookies in a little bag, you know, nothing big. And they were like, here you go. But it's also about, you work with people, but you also patronize their business. You know, let them know that this is a business that you use and you believe in. Don't try to get with someone just because, oh, it looks like a great idea, but support them as well. If you want
right.
them to support you, support them. So that I fully believe in that.
Yeah.
And just ask.
Right. Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. But that's what you're doing when you do your luncheon lecture. You're going back to businesses that you want to support. You're bringing 35
right.
people in there who are going to buy lunch from them. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Okay. So you mentioned another big event that you do, a pop-up gallery. Well, I don't know what you would call it. The African Diaspora exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've
yes.
done that two times, or is it three times already, and you're coming
three
on
three times already.
Okay.
This is our fourth one.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about that, because that hasn't really been in empty spaces, has it? Or it's been at a different space every time you've done
yes.
it, right?
Yes. It started out, we had been talking about doing this. We worked with some guys down in Miami. They have an event called Art Africa, and Anthony was one of the exhibiting artists with that group. So he wanted to work alongside a lot of those great artists, because they're amazing. And so he approached the Armory Arts Center, I think it was in 2013, and asked them, would they be interested in doing a exhibition of artists of African descent in the space. So national and local and, you know, regional.
Okay.
So they were like, sure. So again, we knew the artists we wanted to be part of this. So we didn't do a formal call. We contacted these artists directly, and every last one of them, I think except one couldn't participate because he was out of the country. So he couldn't participate, but we were able to get, a lot. I want to say like 35 artists or something like that to be part of that show.
Oh,
and
that's great.
The vision was kind of like a Harlem Renaissance concept, where it included also music and literature. So I wrote a book with nine other women of African descent, or eight other women of African descent. It was called The Mighty Nine. So we literally connected art, music, and literature in that space. So what was cool was it was a nonprofit connected, so we did have funding backing it. So the second year we did it, Palm Beach State College requested the exhibition in their space as an education component. So we stuck to, we did have a couple of national, it was a smaller group, probably about 10 or 11 artists were involved. And it was an opportunity for their students to learn from these artists. So part of their criteria, they had to interview the artists. The artists were there first night, and some of them got to speak, but they got to learn about their mission and their strategies of art and their personal situations that inspired them. So that was year two. Year three, the Center for Creative Education approached me because we co-collaborated on a couple of projects, and I teach there, so they asked me if we could bring it there, so we did. And it was specifically artists from Florida. They didn't okay. necessarily have to live in Florida now, but they had to originate from Florida or live in Florida. So we had the Highwaymen as part of that. Jonathan Knight, who is renowned, he's internationally renowned now. He's had his work at Sunfest. He's has his own books of watercolor, amazing artist. And then we had some new artists that were involved, like Scott Jeffries, who was kind of just starting out on the scene at that time. So we had established artists who had been in the business for, I won't say a million years, but for a long time. And yeah. then we had a lot of emerging artists and everything in between. So it was a really good variety of work, from jewelry to paintings to sculptures to photography. So, and it was also for an education component, but also bringing the community to the new space that Center for Creative Education has in Northwood. It's not so new now, but
right.
at the
yeah.
time it was just finishing up their construction. So it was a nice connection.
Yeah.
Since I've been with them for now going on 14 years. So it was cool to be able to curate in a space that I had been working with for so many years on the education component to
right.
then curate a show there. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's
great. And, you know,
great.
Full circle.
And the fact that they approached you because of your reputation.
Yeah.
They said, hey, do you want to bring this diaspora show back? That's
absolutely.
That's great. So now you're doing it again, and that's coming up soon. Who are you? What is the venue? Who are you doing with it this time?
We are working with the Related Group, which are the people who are over City Place. So those of you
okay.
who probably, we were talking about the last two continuums, the spaces that they provided us is thanks to Related Group. So there a lot. We got the approval that we will be in the old Banana Republic space, which
okay.
is closer to the convention center side of which, what is that? The east end.
Okay.
The south end. The south end.
Yeah. So this is City Place is an outdoor shopping area, and they've,
right.
they have a couple of empty spaces. So the last 2 years they've given you, it was two different spaces, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Two different spaces
yes.
for Continuum. Now they're giving you a space for African Diaspora. That's great.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a plus and a minus. We have a little bit more control of the programming, but part of it is that we have to do our own fundraising, so that we're in fundraising mode right now,
okay.
actually, as we speak. But aside from that, I mean, it's great because we have total control over the space. Related Group has been really, really great about allowing us to do what we want to do in the spaces. And they do a lot of, again, it goes back to who you connect with that does great PR. So they have a great PR strategy.
Oh, good.
That work with us every time. So.
Okay. And what are the dates of that show? And I'll put that in my show notes.
September 13th to the 22nd.
Okay. So I'll put some details about that. So two things I want to go back to, if I can remember what they were. One of them was with one of your African Diaspora shows, you created a book with or called The Mighty Nine. And
yes.
that was a collaboration between nine artists was,
mm-hmm.
and that book was created just for that show.
It was.
Okay.
I did a call for women writers, black women writers around the country. Cause I actually, at that time, I think I had like 3,000 followers on Facebook or something.
Oh, wow.
And had submissions. And ironically enough, the submissions that were sent to me, two of them were high school alumni. Another one was a person that I used to run a forum with. I didn't realize these women were great writers. And then some
oh, okay.
of them I had just known in the community, knew of, like read their books or have done projects with them.
Okay.
So I was stunned to realize how great writers these women were. And it was basically all, either short stories, you know, words of affirmation, different things like that. And it was basically showing the prospects of different women in different walks of life. Some are married, some have children, some are divorced, some have never been married. Some are educators, some are in the medical field. So just different walks of life with interesting experiences to share. So that was the premise of it. So it was called the Mighty Nine because they're all mighty women.
Okay.
In different aspects of life. So, it was a really cool project.
Yeah. Yeah. And so were you one of the nine or were you just the editor of the book?
Yeah, I was one of the nine.
Okay.
I was one of the nine.
Is that the first book that you've published or have you, I know you've done other books. I'd like to hear about some of them as well.
That was my fourth book that I published.
Ah, okay.
I published three books prior. Two of them were books of art, poetry, and words. I don't want to call it a poetry book because there's a lot of different things in there, but it has okay. art in there as well. Some of my work, some of Anthony's work, actually a piece of my mother's works in there, and
oh,
my
very
son's
nice.
Artwork.
Okay.
And then, so those two are just basically, one's called, and I want to see, What Is My Priority? That was my first book.
Okay.
The other one was called Two-Faced Devil's Advocate. So after that, people had bought those books and they were like watching my tweets come across their Twitter accounts or comments on Facebook. And someone said, you need to make a book about your tweets. So then I did a book called Tweets, Rants, and Affirmations after that. So that was my third book.
Okay.
And then my final book, I did a cookbook. My son had been nagging me for years when he was younger. You need to do a cookbook of stuff that grandma did and you. And so what I did was I did a call again for people that wanted to share recipes from their family history. And I put it all in one cookbook. And I was raised on, believe it or not just soul food, but on Caribbean food and Spanish food. So a lot of the people that reached out to me were people from my community that I grew up in.
Okay.
And some of their parents and grandparents were open to giving them the recipe because they knew it would be published. They couldn't get the recipe until they got this opportunity to be in a cookbook. So it was kind of cool.
Yeah, so, that's great.
So yeah, that was my, and I'm supposed to be, I've been putting off doing my second cookbook, but I, eventually we'll get that second cookbook out.
Oh, that's great. Where are these books available if anyone wants to buy them?
So the first three
okay.
that I told you about, that's on blurb.com.
Okay.
And the way you look it up is that you type in ATB into the, when you go on the page, you type ATB and they have an actual bookstore. And
okay.
you can find those three books.
I'll put a link to that.
Okay. And the second one is on, the two of those are on Amazon. So you can find The Mighty Nine and So Much More from Scratch. Those are both on Amazon.
Oh, okay,
and I'll give
great.
You the links to that too.
Okay, good, good. Now, one last question I wanted to ask you. You just mentioned Twitter. What do you think is the best way to get your word out as an artist in social media right now? Because I think the trends change. What do you think is the big trend right now?
It really depends. I'm
okay.
not a Snapchat person, but a lot of the younger people are using Snapchat. So if you want to connect to a younger audience, Snapchat and Instagram would probably be your best bet.
That makes sense.
If you're connected to a business audience and you just want to get something out there quick, Twitter is the best option. And if you just are doing a lot of different things, then Facebook. So
okay.
Facebook allows for like events and, you know,
event
a
pages,
lot of
right.
and photos. So if you really want people to get more of an experience, then Facebook would be your option.
Okay.
So it really depends on who you're trying to target.
Okay. And you do all of those. Do yeah. you do Snapchat or no?
I don't do Snapchat
okay.
now.
All right. Well, I'll do.
My sons do, and sometimes
yeah.
they'll, you know, post some stuff, but I'm not a Snapchat girl. I'm too old for that.
Yeah, someone told me my son posted a funny video of himself, and so I had to go on my daughter's Snapchat to see my son's video. So yeah, I don't do that either.
Yeah, no, that interested. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's something for everybody. And I think that, that demographic really, we have to try to find a way to connect with them. So for me, it's Instagram just because, you know, they are on there enough to be able to see some of the things that we do and have expressed interest, especially like with the fashion shows we connect with and right. those kind of things. So, and that demographic, we really have to find a way to do it because I don't think they understand the true importance of art in their lives. And if we could find a way to reach them, that would be the best case scenario to find.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. Well, this has been a great conversation. We've covered an awful lot.
I know. Yeah. It was a lot.
But you do so much. I wanted to, I knew this would go more than an hour, but I really wanted to hit on everything that you do. And, you know, I do the artist interviews on a Wednesday, and then on Friday, I post a little mini business episode. And Friday's episode after your interview, I'm going to talk about how you put on a pop-up art show, because a lot of people want to do it, whether it's just using a portion of a space in a filled shop or gallery, or even doing it in their own home, especially around the holidays. So I may come back to you to get a few more notes on that. But
absolutely.
Yeah, but this has been great. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Good. Oh my gosh. Did you get inspired by hearing about how Trina Slade Burks has created these pop-up galleries? She shared so much information here. I think the biggest thing she said that you should remember is, it doesn't hurt to ask. So go ahead and ask a building owner if you can use their empty space. Go ahead and ask your artist friends if they'd like to show their artwork with you. Ask local businesses if they'd like to donate food or drinks for your art show. It doesn't hurt to ask. Here are some other great takeaways from this episode. Number one, join an artist group to meet other local artists and find out about the art scene. If there's no local group near you, consider starting one. Trina was instrumental in the formation of the Artists of Palm Beach County, which became a great resource for her in her business. Number two, if you are having trouble getting your artwork seen in local galleries, why not host your own art exhibit in your home? Invite other artists to join you. Number three, alternative spaces are great for art exhibits because they give a different feel than that of a traditional gallery. Number four, when hosting a show with multiple artists, provide them a mailer or artwork for social media that they can use to invite all of their contacts. Number five, using a call to artists to find artists for your pop-up gallery will up the seriousness and professionalism that you receive from the artists. This will also make it easier to keep track of everything. Number six, develop relationships with local businesses that you can utilize when you do a pop-up gallery. This includes local art schools, chambers of commerce, and restaurants and coffee shops. Number seven, if you can, have entertainment in front of your pop-up gallery to draw people in. Number eight, offer a variety of events during the time of your pop-up to appeal to all kinds of people. Some people may like the loud, splashy opening night, and others may like a quieter, less crowded time to look at the art. Number nine, when you approach people for sponsorships, make sure they have the same goals as you. And number 10, when planning an event, try to include other forms of art like music or literature. Trina has included book signings, fashion shows, and art demos. On Friday, in episode 30, I'll be talking about how you can do a pop-up gallery. I'll try to summarize what Trina talked about and try not to leave out any of the major details. Trina and her husband Anthony have created shows with as many as 70 artists and have had thousands of people come through to see the artwork. They utilize a team of helpers to accomplish this, and you can too. As always, I post a lot of photos of the artist's artwork and business in my show notes for the episode. I've posted a few from their pop-up events so you can see what we've been talking about. So be sure to check them out on my website, SuzanneRedmond.com. For any South Florida artists who are listening to this right now, look for the link to the Continuum pop-up gallery, which has a call to artists due October 31st, 2017. This is a great gallery and event to be a part of. If you're enjoying these podcasts, be sure to go on iTunes and leave me a review. And thank you for listening to the Left Brain Artist Podcast. I'm Suzanne Redman. See you next time.